This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, declared the first 6 months of 2017 the second warmest on record. Care to guess what's in first place? 2016. This year, climate scientists expected things to cool down, but that hasn't happened. Here to tell us more about it, as well as other short subjects in science, is Sophie Bushwick, Senior Editor for Popular Science. Good to see you again, Sophie.
Thanks for having me.
So what happened? This year is warmer? Cooler? What happened?
This year is actually cooler than 2016, but we were actually expecting that. So in 2016, we had El Nino, which is a weather phenomenon which tends to give us warmer temperatures. So you'd expect an El Nino year to be warmer. But 2017, we don't have El Nino, and yet we still have these really high temperatures, high enough to be in second place in terms of hottest temperature year on record. And that's a big problem because that suggests that global warming is really pushing up the temperatures. You can think of sort of El Nino compared to global warming as a ride on an escalator almost. So global warming is the escalator taking you up. And El Nino is kind of like if you hopped up in place a couple times, you'd get a little higher and then come back down. But global warming is the thing that's gradually taking you up.
So have these warmer temperatures have been affecting weather patterns around?
Yeah, they have. So Canada this year has been reporting more flooding than would be normal for them. Normally, their weather kind of a rainstorm comes in and then it goes back out again. Yeah. But weather has lingered there more, which is causing flooding. And another issue we're having is more frequent droughts in Montana and the Dakotas in the States. And then another thing that we're seeing is a lot of severe wildfires. So right now we've got wildfires in British Columbia in Canada, in California in the States, and in Southern Europe. And so this is the type of nasty weather phenomenon that you can expect to see more frequently in a warmer planet.
The new normal.
Yeah.
Let's move on a little bit. Not a great week for environmental news, it seems. A study has estimated the amount of plastic that we humans have created over the last 50 years or so. And it's a lot, isn't it?
It's 9.1 billion tons.
Wow.
That's billion with a B. Basically, if you took all that plastic and if you're comparing it in weight, it's like if you took 25,000 Empire State Buildings made out of plastic.
25,000?
Yeah, that's the weight.
So if you lie those down in New York, could we cover Manhattan? I don't know how many.
Oh, absolutely.
How deeply you'd be walking or whatever, living in it.
Right. And that's the amount of plastic we've produced entirely. It's not necessarily the amount that's in the world right now. But the problem is that of all this plastic we're pumping out, we only recycle 9% of it.
Wow.
Yeah. So
it's been increasing almost geometrically then over the last few years.
Right. They're estimating we'll be at 13 billion tons in 2050. It just is going to keep going up.
And we see it washing up on those islands in the Pacific.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. It's sort of clumping together into these garbage masses in the ocean, and you see it on land getting into nature as well.
So recycling is really not working for plastic.
Well, I think the problem with recycling is we're not recycling enough, and that even as we recycle, we keep using more of it. So one thing that you can do is to stop getting as much plastic in the first place. Like if you're shopping in the grocery store, bring a reusable bag so you don't have to use up plastic bags, and maybe choose items that aren't wrapped in plastic. I love getting takeout, but as much as it hurts to say it, that stuff is really heavily packaged.
Those dishes they put them in now instead of little boxes?
Right, the little plastic clamshells.
I use them for my saucers, for my plants, at least I'm reusing them.
Right, that's good. So yeah, if you are getting those, at least you can get more than one use out of them instead of just getting more and more.
Yeah, I have to get more plants. next, we have not one but two studies measuring how fast a T-Rex may have been able to run. This was big news all over the web this week, wasn't it?
Yes. I think that we're all very excited to decide whether a T-Rex would be able to catch us if it was chasing us.
Oh, of all the things we need. Well,
In a Jurassic Park world, you want to know these things. So the two studies used totally different methodologies, though. So one looked at like the mechanics of how a T-Rex would have run, and they said basically a T-Rex would have done more like a brisk walk, that if it tried to run, it would put too much stress on its body. But according to this study, a brisk walk for a T-Rex would be more than 12 miles per hour. And so that's not nearly as fast as a sprinter like Usain Bolt, who can run at nearly 30 miles an hour at his fastest. But compare it to a marathon runner, a winning marathon runner would be going faster than that. But like I think your average marathoner, a good marathoner would be doing, about 12 about 12 miles an hour, so being just barely even with the T-Rex, which isn't good.
Another study, so there were two studies on how fast they're going,
right? So the other study was basically looking at a lot of animals and saying, how does an animal's size relate to how fast it can go? And so when they were looking at like a curve, because you would expect the bigger animals have bigger muscles that can run faster, but the fastest land animal is a cheetah, which isn't that large. So the idea is that once you get past a certain size threshold, all that extra size starts being too much weight to run as quickly.
Are there other dinosaurs that did run really fast?
Yeah, we think velociraptors could have gone at about 34 miles an hour.
34? It's like a horse.
They could eat Usain Bolt really easily. Just like, you know, velociraptors are sort of, you can picture them as terrifying chickens, like sort of terrifying oversized chickens. And yeah, they could definitely run down even the fastest human. I think that's a scarier prospect than the T-Rex.
Yeah, that's what happened in the movies.
Yeah, the movies were right. Who knew?
Oh, no. Although we're not sure about the feathers and things that they had on.
The feathers are still up in the air, so to speak. But I think that I kind of like picturing them with feathers because if you've ever been attacked by a goose, those things are mean.
They sure are. Finally, we can't let you go without mentioning Elon Musk. His tweet this week, he said he has permission from the government to build the Hyperloop, sort of a verbal permission.
Right. So I'm glad that Elon Musk is excited about his Hyperloop, but he's going to need a lot more than verbal permission. He's going to need a lot more than permission from just one government. So he's proposing a Hyperloop that would connect New York, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia, and that would be able to deliver passengers from, I think, New York to D.C. in 29 minutes, which sounds great in theory. But in order to dig the tunnel for that, he doesn't just need permission from the federal government. He needs permission from the state governments. He needs to get approval from the locals whose property he's going to be tunneling under. People need to do environmental impact studies. And then they've got a bunch above-ground structures. Like, how are you going to get out of the Hyperloop without some above-ground structure and an elevator? And
look, you know, we can't even get a bridge to Jersey built. So,
yeah.
Good luck with that one.
Yeah, I feel like he's being maybe a whole lot too optimistic.
Thank you, Sophie. Always good to talk to you.
You too.
Sophie Bushwick, a senior editor at Popular Science. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Earth's forests are great carbon guzzlers, and you know they are crucial for biodiversity. But what happens when the person who owns the land the forest is on needs the trees for firewood? One solution being tried in countries like Costa Rica and Uganda is to pay the landowner to not cut down the trees. Sounds like agriculture. Can these programs work, or are there loopholes? Let me bring in my guest, Jaya Chandran, Dr. Seema Jaya Chandran, Associate Professor of Economics at Northwestern University. She's the lead author on a new research paper in the journal Science that explores how well these payments work. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Jaya Chandran.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be on your show.
Let's talk about it. What makes people, paying people, you know, such an attractive option here?
Yeah, like you said, the forests are storing a lot of carbon, so it would be great to keep them intact. But a lot of the forest is in developing countries, and a lot of where the deforestation is happening is by very poor people. So where in Uganda, you know, people are selling some trees to timber dealers or for charcoal just to make ends meet. And so if we just ban them from cutting down their trees, we wouldn't be making poor people even worse off. And so the idea of paying them is that, you know, we can still get them to conserve, but we can offset that money they're losing by not being able to sell their trees. And so they're a little bit better off, and we got our conservation goal. And, you know, it's a lot of money to them, so we don't want to deprive them of that money. But when we think about it in global terms, it's not a lot of money, $50, $100. And so that could be a lot cheaper than some of our other options for reducing carbon emissions.
But Dr. Jaya Chandran, we shouldn't take for granted that paying people actually means more trees automatically.
I mean, yeah, you know, one view is that, like, this is a no-brainer. If you pay people, they'll do more of it. But, you know, there has been some skepticism about this approach. You mentioned, you know, Costa Rica, Mexico, some countries are doing it, and we just haven't known how well it works. And so, you know, kind of the bad of this is less that it's going to hurt the forest, and more that it might not make a big dent in it. And there are a couple reasons people have been skeptical. You know, one is that maybe a lot of the money we're paying people is really to people who would have conserved their forest anyway. You know, some people were going to conserve anyway. This program looks like a great deal to them. They're going to conserve. We're going to pay them. But they didn't change their behavior. We're not getting any extra forest cover. So the programs are only really making a dent in the problem if they attract people who would have been clearing mm-hmm. their forest, but now because of the reward, they change their behavior and they keep it intact. And so that would be a case, you know, if we need to get a lot of that second category to really make this cost effective. And then there's a second concern people have had that's, you know, maybe a little bit more pernicious, which is that, you know, people will enroll and they'll follow the rules of the program and they'll conserve the forest on their land, but then they'll just go and take some trees from the government forest reserve. Or, you know, if you and I were neighbors in a village, I might say, okay, you sign up, I won't.
Right.
And then you can come cut your trees on my land and you'll get the money for complying and we'll split that money.
But your research showed that didn't happen, that people were good about this.
Exactly. So what we did is we said, okay, let's look what happens on the ground. And so we ran a randomized experiment in Uganda and looked at what happened in the villages with the program and compared what happened to deforestations and the ones without it. And we didn't see either of those problems. You know, the program was successful in attracting people across the board. Some of the people who were going to conserve anyway, but also people who would have been deforesting and now they conserved. And we didn't see any of that shifting of deforestation to neighboring land.
That's great. This is a very interesting study. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Seema Jayachandran, Associate Professor of Economics at Northwestern University. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, NASA's first mission to test asteroid deflection. You heard it right. It is moving forward. Why this is a threat that we should be taking seriously. An asteroid hitting us, it's got to be one with our name on it, right? We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you remember the movie Armageddon? If you don't, let me remind you. It starts out a little bit like this, with an asteroid with Earth's name on it.
How big are we talking?
Sir, our best estimate is 97.6 billion.
It's the size of Texas, Mr. President.
Yes, sir.
What kind of damage are we...
Damage? Total, sir. It's what we call a global killer. The end of mankind. Doesn't matter where it hits. Nothing would survive, not even bacteria.
My God. What do we do?
Well, you'll have to see the movie. And while the movie does come with some Hollywood exaggeration, the problem of an asteroid hitting the Earth is not fictional. In 2013, a small meteor exploded over Russia. It was only 20 meters across, but an estimated 1,500 people were injured as a result of the shockwave. According to my next guest, it's not asteroids the size of Texas that we should be worrying about, rather those smaller ones under 200 meters, which are far more numerous and also mostly still undiscovered. What would we do if such a menace is found? NASA has a solution, which may also sound a bit like the plot from Armageddon. Launch a missile about the size of a refrigerator and slam it into the asteroid. But do not try to break it into pieces, as they did in the movie. Hope the force of the impact can change that asteroid's path just enough to keep it hitting the Earth. NASA's DART mission, now in a preliminary design phase, will try to do just that. Joining me now to explain the DART mission and why it's necessary are my guests, Andy Cheng, co-leader for NASA's DART mission and chief scientist of the Space Department at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. Welcome to Science Friday, Andy.
Yes, glad to be here.
You're welcome. Lindley Johnson is Planetary Protection Officer for NASA. Welcome.
Yes, Lindley Johnson. That's Planetary Defense Officer, by the way.
Defense Officer. Well, tell us why there is a Planetary Defense Office.
Well, the hazard of asteroids crossing Earth's orbit and being a potential for collision and impact of the Earth is a real thing. And so our job is to try to find any of those before they find us.
Andy, you know, a lot of people don't think about this. Should they be thinking more about it?
Well, we should definitely be doing both finding the asteroids before they get us. We have to find the threat, and then we have to learn we have to do something. So finding them doesn't do any good if we're not going to do anything anyway. And being able, developing a mitigation method doesn't help us if we don't find them.
Right.
So we've got to do both.
All right, let's talk about if everything goes as planned, what's going to happen when the DART mission launches?
Well, when the DART mission launches, the DART mission is a technology demonstration. It will demonstrate the method of deflecting an asteroid by running a spacecraft into it and changing its orbit. So we launch. We actually first spiral out of Earth. We have to get away from Earth. Then we're going to use a long-range telescope, find the target, and use that telescope as we get close to discriminate. Our target is actually a binary asteroid, where our target is orbiting another larger asteroid. We have to separate the two in the telescope, figure out which is the one we want to hit, and then the telescope is used as a homing sensor to home in on it, and we will run the spacecraft into it at about 6 kilometers per second, which is about 9 times the speed of the bullet from an AK-47. And so that impact will change the orbit. It'll basically deflect the target and change its orbit around the other asteroid. And then we'll measure the effect of that change. We'll measure that change in the orbit from Earth with Earth-based observations, telescopes, astronomical observations.
Why do you need to choose? Why do you choose an asteroid where one is orbiting around the other?
Well, there's two reasons. First is that way we can measure the effect of the deflection. We can show that we deflected the asteroid. We can show the change, that the orbit has changed, and we can measure the amount of the change. And we can do that from Earth with ground-based observations. That's the one reason. The other reason is because this asteroid is orbiting another one, we are not going to be changing the orbit of the system around the sun to any appreciable degree.
So that's a safety measure then, so you don't accidentally knock it into a different orbit?
Well, we're not going to knock it into a dangerous orbit.
Yeah. Lindley, what kinds of asteroids are NASA most worried about? They worry about not the size of Texas ones.
No, all the ones the size of Texas have been found, and they are safely in the main belt of asteroids between Mars and Jupiter. We are worried about those that come within 30 million miles of the Earth's orbit and have the potential to cross Earth's path around the sun. So our program, its first priority is to find all these near-Earth asteroids, sort out the ones that are potential hazards to Earth, those that are really coming close to Earth's orbit, determine their size and other characteristics so that if one is on an impact trajectory, we have the information that we need to mount a deflection mission like DART. The whole principle of deflecting an asteroid from an impact of the Earth is just to slow up its speed or speed it up, one of the two, so that when the Earth reaches that point in its orbit that it would impact, the asteroid would have already passed because we sped it up, or it would have not be there yet because mm-hmm. we slowed it down. So the DART mission, slamming the asteroid into it at the right angle and mm-hmm. speed, is designed to slow it down.
How many asteroids do we know about versus how many we think there might be out there that might hit us?
Yeah, okay. Well, it depends on size. The population of all sizes of asteroids that might come near Earth is probably in the millions. Our first objective of our program was to find all those 1 kilometer and larger, and our population estimates for that showed there was a little under 1,000 of those. And we have found 93% or so of those already. So our current objective is to find those down to 140 meters, and we think the population of those is somewhere around 25,000. We've only found a little under 7,700 of those. So we've only found about a third of that size so far. The total number of near-Earth asteroids in our catalog, though, is approaching 17,000.
And how much time and effort and money do we spend on looking for these asteroids?
Well, for the detection, tracking, and characterization, it's a larger part of our program. That is in the $35 to $40 million a year range. So the total amount of our program, including the preliminary development for DART and some other capabilities, is this fiscal year in 2017 was $60 million.
Is that a lot of money?
Well, not relative to a lot of other things that are done. But it's a good amount of money for doing the ground-based portion of our program. And we are doing what we can with the money that is appropriated.
How much time, how much lead time do you need to find an asteroid? And if it's a dangerous one, to make sure you can intercept it?
Well, we certainly want to find it as far ahead of time as we can. We would certainly like to have years, maybe as much as a decade, to be comfortable that we have the time to build the spacecraft or spacecraft. It would be a mission campaign against the asteroid. We'd first like to get a spacecraft out to get a good look at it so we know exactly what we're dealing with before we attempt a deflection like DART or some other technique. Mm-hmm. So 10 years is a good amount of time. It could be less than that, but the shorter amount of time you have, the less options you have to deflect it. Mm-hmm. And even if it's a small object that is only a few months out, just knowing when and where it will impact is of advantage to the emergency response community. They rarely get a chance to know about a disaster that's going to happen before it does. So we would still want to know about it to be able to evacuate people and secure down the infrastructure before the impact.
Could you, 2 or 3 months out, you could be pretty sure of where it's going to hit?
Given enough observations of it, yes. We are able to pretty precisely determine where and when it will impact because the timing of it can be very accurately established.
Mm-hmm. Andy, for discovering and deflecting the dangerous asteroids, can technology advances like in imaging or propulsion or something else help this happen faster and more smoothly?
Well, certainly technology advances can always help. And in fact, DART is a technology demonstration, so we are demonstrating the technology to be able to do this. I wanted to get back, comment one thing about the amount of damage, the kind of disaster that we're talking about averting, even from one of the smaller asteroids, a few hundred meter asteroid impact. If we're talking about something like that over a metropolitan area, you're talking, you know, many billions of dollars of damage and potentially millions of casualties. So we are really talking about a major disaster that's being averted here.
So you're saying that we're not spending, if I read the tea leaves, and not spending enough money to save all those lives and all property.
You're not spending all, well, it's an unlikely but very dangerous event that you are now spending, I would say, a modest sum of money to be able to do something about.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Lindley.
Yeah, well, a couple of examples of what Andy is talking about. The crater, meteor crater is commonly called in eastern Arizona. It's a crater that's over a mile wide. That was created by an object that is estimated to only have been about 50 meters in size. Now, it was an iron asteroid, its ability to penetrate the Earth's atmosphere and hit the ground was greater. But even so, that's not something you'd want to have happen in your backyard. Another more recent event in 1908 in Tunguska, Siberia, was an object only about 40 meters in size. It did not reach the ground. It exploded a few miles above the surface, but even so, the blast wave knocked down some 2,000 square kilometers of Siberian forest, and you would not want that to happen over a metropolitan area.
And how big was that, the Tunguska? Do we know?
About 40 meters in size is the estimate.
Yeah, and that really did some damage and knocked the whole forest down, didn't it?
Right, yeah. Now, had it happened maybe 3 hours later, that would have put it in the vicinity of Moscow.
Wow. Do we know why? What's so special about Russia, why they got the last two big events, the one that we're talking about?
Russia's just a big country.
Russia has the largest landmass within its borders.
So let me give you my blank check question. If you had a blank check, I know you never get this. I don't have one in my back pocket, just let you know. And you want to spend it and create the ideal system for tracking and tracing and then maybe moving asteroids headed our way. What would it look like? Let me ask you, Lindley, first.
The things that we need to do to find them, track them, and then demonstrate capability to deflect one, the most frequent case would be a smaller size object of 100 meters or so in size. That kind of a program could be done on a yearly budget in the $200 to $250 million dollars a year range.
It's really fairly
modest. This is not something that we need to be spending billions of dollars on.
Yeah.
But we do need to have better capability than we have today.
Yeah. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Of course, sometimes popular culture can help people to get things going. They're not always accurate. I mean, in the film, I think they broke up the asteroid. That's not a good thing to do because you get a lot of little asteroids coming in that are going to be harder.
That's right. Yeah, we'd like to keep it intact if at all possible.
Yeah, and I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Do you have any advice, anybody who's listening? Anything to do immediately? Andy?
Advice? No, I'm not. Sorry.
Well, we need to continue to pursue this program at a reasonable pace. NASA is certainly working with our administration and Congress to determine what the right amount is. We are also working with our international partners in this. We work with the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency, Russia as well, Roscosmos, mm-hmm. and the Academy of Sciences in Russia. It's a worldwide problem. You never know where an asteroid is going to strike. It could strike anywhere. So it's a good area for not only a national capability, but for international collaboration.
All right. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Andy Cheng, co-leader for NASA's DART mission, chief scientist of the Space Department at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. Lindley Johnson, planetary protection officer for NASA. Have a good weekend, and thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thank you for your interest. Thank you.
You're welcome. And because all great adventures need an heroic theme, here's a musical tribute written and performed by our own Rachel Boughton, produced by Daniel Peterschmidt. For the most scientifically accurate Aerosmith parody you might ever hear. Take a listen.
I could end all life and boil all your oceans. I could make so many awesome explosions. But you just wanna push me away with Newton's laws of motion.
Trajectory just sounds so dumb.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You may not know what a Quindar is, but you have definitely heard one.
The Eagle has landed. Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Remember those little beeps in the background? They are Quindar tones. They're almost as iconic as Neil Armstrong's The Eagle Has Landed quote. Those tones are created by ground control to turn on and off the radio transmitters used to talk to astronauts. Quindar tones, named after the company that made the equipment, were so ubiquitous during the 60s space race to the moon and right into the shuttle program that my next guests took inspiration from them as they combed through NASA's audio archives, all in a quest to make an album, a soundtrack telling the story of spaceflight. Please welcome the member of the musical group Quindar, and their new album is called Hip Mobility. Michael Jorgensen, when he's not exploring the bleeps and pings of NASA, is keyboardist for the band Wilco. He's based out in Ojai, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. James Merle Thomas is a musician and art historian based out of Philadelphia. Welcome to you, too.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
James, you both have been trying to collaborate on a project together for a while. What was the light bulb in your head? Why did this NASA material make sense to you guys?
Well, to tell that story is to go back to about 2011, 2012. And at the time when I was finishing my doctorate, I was working as a fellow at the National Air and Space Museum. And at the time, I was looking at how artists and architects were collaborating with engineers at NASA to design for space. In other words, what it meant to build something like the interior of Skylab as a kind of house that would be different from a regular spacecraft. And when I was researching that material, I started encountering a lot of archival stuff, old industrial films, archival audio. And it's not the stuff of the heroic missions that we always think of. It wasn't the countdowns. It wasn't the triumphant sound clips, but it was really the mundane stuff of every day. It was tape hiss. It was microphones that were left on. It was people talking about what it meant to, what it felt like to live in space for a long time. And it felt almost like a deep portrait of what it meant to live at that given moment in a very unique place. And I thought that would make an excellent starting point for telling a story or making some compositions using those sounds.
And so why did you choose the Quindar? What does that sound represent to you, Michael?
Well, Michael, do you want to jump in?
Sure. when James and I had first had our initial writing session in 2011, we would text each other in between these writing sessions, and I remember saying, Hey, what are those sounds? What are those beeps called? Surely they've got a name. And then, and James like, oh, those are called Quindar tones. And I was like, oh man, well that's the name of this. And then we further discovered what a Quindar tone was, and it is, as you sort of described earlier, it is a handshake between telemetry systems that keep the mission control and spacecraft communications open. So it's sort of like a are you there? And then the spacecraft's like, yeah, I'm here. Are you still there? And back and forth. And it sort of talks about some element of what it is that we do musically.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys consider yourselves geeks? I was thinking about
it. I do. I just own it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because I was looking, Michael, you're the keyboardist in Wilco, and was Wilco chosen because of its reference to Roger Wilco, two-way radio stuff?
It's part of the band history that I wasn't around at that point, the genesis of the band, but it is also part of it speaks to this disconnected transmission of musical ideas or of emotion through radio waves, and you would back before the internet, you would listen to music on a discrete box that had a battery, and you could take it with you and hear this music. And I think that the Roger Wilco is also sort of like an acknowledgement of a communication received.
Yeah, enough of talking about your music. Let's listen to some of it, because people want to hear how you've got the Quindar tones into your music and all these other background music. So I'm going to play a clip called Honeysuckle, and let's listen to Honeysuckle. This is Houston.
Certainly can. All configured. 1, 2, 3, 4.
That's cool. I like that. James, what was your approach to putting that track out there?
Well, I think when we started listening to this audio, and indeed the first part of making a Quindar record is sitting around and listening to hours and hours of archival audio, one of the first things that leapt out to us right away is that you hear that difference in the two tones. They're actually at two different frequencies. And we were struck by the fact that, you know, this is basically a synthesizer that NASA is playing, right? This is a mm-hmm. this is a kind of complex note structure that's being beamed out into the ether. And so we immediately started thinking, well, what if we push and pull with this kind of fixed industrial standard and think about it less like a precise measure of communication and think about it more like an expressive instrument. And it was a really short path from that way of thinking to then thinking about, well, what was happening with synthesizers at this same moment, and you know, what were composers like Stockhausen or John Cage doing when they were using similar devices to create sounds? And in that very same track, if you listen a little deeper later on, you start hearing these really sort of rich, dense, textural sounds that sound a lot like an organ. The, you mm-hmm. know, the Quindar tones are throughout the whole record. You hear them in a lot of different ways.
Let's actually play. I'm going to play a Quindar, the actual Quindar sound. If people want to, you'll recognize it immediately. And actually, if you listen, there are two tones to it. They're not quite exactly the same frequency, are they, Michael?
No, they're not a musical interval apart, but they are, I think, something maybe like 100 hertz or something different from each other.
Mm-hmm. And there are two tones, one just to sort of turn on the transmission, one to bring it back?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you heard that? I mean, that's sort of an iconic sound for anybody who listened to the Space Race over the 60s and into the 70s. I'm going to play another one of your cuts called the Chaco Hilton, and I want people to listen to Chaco Hilton, and we'll talk about it. Now, what was your inspiration for that?
Well, you can probably make out that there was some sort of astronaut-sounding chatter going on there, and I thought it would be interesting to take the actual, to maybe just work with the sound of the transmissions rather than the information that was part of the message. So it is really kind of like using the shell of the information, and I took those conversations, and I sliced it up in the computer and was able to access different parts of a phrase, and then resequenced it with a rhythmic pattern. And that to me was like it was more of like a percussive element, or like a shaker or a drum kind of element. And I thought it was kind of interesting to take what typically is the focal point of a song, where like mm-hmm. in a traditional sense of like a person playing acoustic guitar or piano and then singing lyrics, you know, take that and sort of subvert it a little bit.
Yeah, because it does have that sound back, you know, in the 60s, that kind of rhythm to it. And I know, James, you studied NASA during the Cold War era. Why is that period interesting to you?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's another chapter in the American experience. I think, you know, I approached it, you know, I've been working on a lot of this material from the perspective of being an art historian and someone who's really interested in aesthetic questions and how different kinds of media intersect with technology. So, you know, a good parallel to all of this would be an artist like Robert Rauschenberg, who was actually invited by NASA in July of 69 to travel to the Cape and to witness the launch of Apollo 11. And Rauschenberg was, you know, he was an official guest of the agency, and like a number of other artists, he was asked to provide some kind of interpretation of the experience. Mm. Only Rauschenberg didn't set up an easel and paint like everyone else. He immediately started rooting around in the engineer's trash cans and found schematics and blueprints and tourist maps from Cocoa Beach. And he really upended the narrative that NASA was trying to create and made a sort of wild kaleidoscopic set of collages. They're called Stoned Moon. And I think that, you know, there's something in the spirit of rewriting a narrative, of maybe thinking differently about the way a countdown works or the way that we're told a story and to reshuffle the order in which it's told. I think there's something in that way of thinking that really really informed the way that we were thinking about composition on this album.
Mm-hmm. This is all quite interesting stuff here. What's the meaning behind, we just played the Chaco Hilton. What was the meaning behind the little Chaco Hilton? What does that mean?
There's a great backstory there. I think, well, especially on a day like this, whenever, you know, it's the anniversary of Armstrong and crew coming back from the moon, we're thinking about the kind of pristine spaces that they occupied, right? The clean rooms, the pressurized chambers, the quarantine space on the deck of the Hornet and whatnot. Well, there's a whole other side to NASA to think about. I was really struck by the fact that in the run-up to all of these missions, the astronauts had to do a lot of training in the tropics and in extreme climates to plan for different kinds of possible outcomes. And Chaco Hilton is an affectionate name given to the shack that the astronauts were staying in whenever they were doing training in Central America and were encountering any number of indigenous persons at that time. And I think the idea of NASA and the tropics is a very different kind of image than the one that we normally associate with the agency.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, so just joined us. We're talking with Michael Jorgensen and James Merle Thomas about Quindar. You have to say it correctly. Cause, you know.
So nice it beeps twice.
Well, Michael, as a musician, the technology that was coming out of NASA must have been pretty, speaking of that, but must have been pretty interesting to you.
Sure. You know, as a lifelong fan of 3-2-1 contact and Newton's apple, my space and science fascination was early and profound. And in hindsight too, because you know, we live in a time that is so sort of digital, and the NASA missions were sort of very sort of like unapologetically, and well, I mean, they didn't really have a choice, but analog. There was, you know, like 16-millimeter film and magnetic tape going up into space, capturing sounds and images. The advancements, advances that were made due to the space agency funding, sort of directly inspired and made technologies available for commercial synthesizer apparatus. You know, the Quindar module being a kind of prime example. My dad was a recording engineer in New York City, and he brought me to the studio where I kind of first saw my first control panel, where I was like, wow, this is amazing. And not only is this like seductive and blinking and view meters wiggling, there's people playing music on the other side of the glass, and having that sort of experience as the foundation of my kind of musical and technical career in a way, sort of this intersection of NASA and electronic music sort of, to me, was a logical extension of all of those interests.
Before our time runs out, I want to get to another track. There's a track about two spiders who were sent to space. let's listen and talk about why that story interested you. Michael, the sound of interest on that one was right at the beginning, sort of in the background, right? That's where you hear it.
Yeah, that's right. That moment actually was kind of a gym genesis. So I'll let him take the reins on this one here.
Well, the sounding question came from a microphone just being dragged across the table before a press conference. And it's sort of indicative of the way Quindar works. Sometimes we start with a sound, we build a whole song around it, and then we scale it out and pull it back in. And then the only thing that's left is a sort of fragment or trace of the original archival sound. So in that case, you know, the sort of prelude to the actual message was the sound that we kept. But you were alluding to the message, the sort of humble story or the sort of poignant story there. And I like to think of the song as a kind of elegy to the two spiders that so prominently figured into some of the Skylab experiments. There's something sweet about making a song for a grade school science experiment that a number of astronauts helped to realize then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you great luck with your album. They're really interesting. It's really interesting music. We have a little bit from Hip Mobility on our website at sciencefriday.com/Quindar. Thanks for evolving the music with us. And
thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Thanks for all you guys do, and it's quite interesting stuff. Thanks for coming
on. Thanks so much. It's wonderful to speak with you.
Michael Jorgensen is a keyboardist for the band Wilco. James Merle Thomas is a musician and an art historian, and they both make up the group Quindar. And as I say, there is a little bit of a clip from their album Hip Mobility on our website at sciencefriday.com/Quindar. Charles Berkowitz is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Haller. Neil Rausch engineered our show today. Also, thanks to Brian McCabe and all the folks over at NPR for their studio help this week. If you'd like to write us, send your letter to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can email us. You know, our SciFry address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. And, of course, every day is Science Friday on the web. We're tweeting all day, every day, and Facebooking and everywhere else on social communities. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.